The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is day one of this October Sesshin at Mountain Gate. And it's a kind of an odd day. It's the first weekend for the Balloon Fiesta down in Albuquerque, and I'm not sure they're very happy with the weather. But at any rate, it's nice to have the extra moisture. It's actually quite beneficial to have the extra moisture. I'd like to share with you today something of the life of Hakuin. Hakuin Ikkaku is the name he finally took. He was born in 1686 in Japan in a little town called Hara. And Hara was a very important little town, even though it was a very little town, maybe 250 families at the time, which is not much bigger than Ohosaka, which has got 140 families. And his father had actually been born into a samurai family, but when he got married, he took his wife's name and eventually assumed the highest position in her family, which was the chief of the Hara Gate. Now, when we talk about Hara Gates, at that period of history in Japan, the daimyo were required, at great expense, and this was partly to keep them from, or maybe completely to keep them from, having the money to rise up against the head of the country. They were required to go from their home area to what was called Edo in those days, which is modern-day Tokyo, for annual meetings. And they were in Tokyo for approximately 3 months every year, and the rest of the time they were coming and going or back home. And when they were coming and going, they came in, it was almost like a circus troupe. A vast number of people, part of the entourage of the daimyo. They had jugglers, they had acrobats, they had all kinds of interesting folk as part of that entourage. It must have been quite a scene in those days. And they all traveled along what's known as the Hokkaido, the great Eastern Sea Road, along the shores around Suraga Bay from other parts of Japan to Tokyo. And Ohara still exists. It's called Ohara now. And all the O may be just an honorific. And there were gates all along the road. It was a toll road, basically. And the gates were run by families who provided extra horses, replacement horses, and other amenities, lodging, and so on, to the daimyo and his entourage, and made their money that way. So Hakuin's parents ran one of those inns, and I guess you would really call it a post because it included an inn, but it also included the capacity to replace the animals of the entourage and provide them with whatever necessities they needed for the next leg of the journey. So that's how Hakuin grew up, in that kind of fascinating atmosphere. And he actually used some of the images from those entourages in his artwork and also in his teaching. He was the last kid born into that family. I think there were 5 kids. He had an older brother, and he was like any little boy. rather rambunctious. He and his little buddies used to take their slingshots out and try to kill crows. And they succeeded periodically. And they did other things. And then one day when he was about 10 years old, his mother took him to a lecture by a Nichiren Buddhist priest, in which the guy extolled the terrors of hell. And young Hakuin took it pretty seriously and became quite terrified himself that he would end up in hell because of his childhood antics. And then one day, he was at home and the maid was preparing the Japanese bath. And in those days, there was actually a fire under the bath. Nowadays, it's either a fiberglass or a stainless steel tub. And it just gets the hot water out of the tap. But in those days, you actually had to build a fire under it. And the maid must have been distracted because she let the fire go too high or too long, and the water actually started bubbling and boiling. And there was young Hakuin, who was about to take his bath, and memories of the talk by the Nichiren priest about being dropped into boiling oil and various other amenities that they seem to have had in the hells of the time, was terrified, and he wouldn't get in the bath. And his mother kept coaxing him and finally said, "I'll only get in if you tell me how I can not go to hell." And she said, I will. And he said, "Tell me now." And he said, I'll tell you after your bath. I'll tell you tomorrow." So he went ahead and took his bath and the next day came and his mother tried to fudge it. And he realized that she didn't know. And that scared him even more. And at a certain point, she finally said, "You were born in the hour of a particular god of a shrine, a Shinto shrine, on the day of honoring that god. And as long as you honor that god, then you will not go to hell." So he set up a little altar honoring the god, and he would chant to the god and do what he could to ensure his safety and avoidance of hell. And then one day he began to get a little suspicious. Was this really going to work? Did his mom really know what she was talking about? And so he decided that what he would do would be to light a stick of incense, as usual, and then close his eyes. And if the incense smoke rose straight up, it would be a sign from the god Tengu that he was on target. And if it didn't, then maybe that was not the way to avoid hell. So he lit the stick of incense, put it in the incense pot, closed his eyes tight, opened them again, and the smoke was rising straight up. And he began to feel hugely relieved, and then some kind of air current came along, and it started going zigzag. And so his heart sank. And so the next thing that happened was his mother took him to another lecture. This again by a Buddhist priest, and apparently there was a Buddhist priest in history, or at least in folklore, who had been condemned to torture. The torture being having a red hot iron pot placed on his head, over his head. So this was demonstrated. It was a play, and this was demonstrated. And the person playing the condemned priest just stood there as if it was a nice, cool, summer day, and there was just a nice cool breeze on his head. And so then Hakuin thought, aha, okay, now if I become a Buddhist priest, I'll escape hell. And by this time he was 12, 13 years old. And he began to go up in the woods behind his house, up the hills. And there was a place where there was a rock that he actually carved into the face of Kuan Yin. And he used to sit with that rock and do Zazen to the degree that he knew how to do Zazen. He would sit there for hours, actually. He was quite determined, or quite terrified and ready to do whatever it took to escape hell. And by the time he was 13 years old, he started asking his parents if they wouldn't please let him go into a monastery. And they wouldn't, but finally, when he was 14, they relented. And so he was taken to his uncle's temple, which was in Hara, his little Buddhist temple, and was ordained there. And then he was sent to train with another Buddhist priest in another temple, where he learned sutras. It was not a Zen temple. He learned sutras and helped out at the temple and did various things like that. It's not clear whether there was Zazen or not, but I would expect he would have probably continued his Zazen. And then fast forward a few years, and he heard a lecture by another Buddhist priest in which he spoke of the life of Ganto. Ganto was a very, very highly regarded, deeply realized Chinese master who unfortunately died quite young and rather violently at the hands of bandits. And when Hakuin heard that not only had Ganto died violently, he'd been murdered really, but that when he was run through with a sword, he screamed so loud that it was heard 9 miles away. And once more, young Hakuin's heart sank. He put all his eggs in the Buddhist basket, and now it looked like he'd done the wrong thing. And he became extremely, extremely discouraged in practice. And in fact, at one point, he actually quit practice and decided that he would do better as a calligrapher. Well, he apprenticed himself to a master calligrapher, and it was very clear after some months that he was never going to be a master calligrapher himself, which is ironic because he ended up being an incredible calligrapher with a vast array of styles and a prodigious amount of calligraphy that he did, making calligraphies, scrolls for his students and friends. And so he went back to it. And at one point, and I don't know if it was right after that or soon after, but there was a point at which he was so discouraged, and he was in a temple. I don't think it was the one he was training at. I think it was a different one. But here is how it was translated by Norman Waddell, as shared in the book Wild Ivy, which is a translation of writings of Hakuin. Hakuin also, in addition to being a very prodigious calligrapher, was also a very prodigious writer. And he had left behind many, many, many writings, many, many books in print. He usually, it sounds like, conned some of his students into paying for getting them printed, and others of his students to doing some editing and so on. And At any rate, he had lots and lots and lots of works that were published, and very few of them are actually translated. And Norman Waddell is a wonderful American man who went to Japan because of R.H. Blythe. He was a poet, and Blythe being a poet and headquartered in Japan, Norman went to study poetry with him. And I'm not sure whether he actually got to do that. Blythe might have died by the time Norman went there, but I'm not sure. At any rate, Norman stayed, married a Japanese woman who had the most incredibly beautiful voice I've ever heard, and he taught at Otani University in Japan, and also did a lot of translations of Hakuin, including this Wild Ivy. He also did translations of, the translations of the life of Ba-O, who was a Japanese Buddhist priest who was kind of an iconoclast. And that book is in print. And as I said, there are a number of translations of Hakuin's works that Norman did. And he does an excellent, excellent job of it. A friend in Japan, who's also a translator of Buddhist works and has lived in Japan for 40 years, done translation most of that time, says that Norman has really caught the personality of Hakuin in his translations. In order to translate Hakuin, Norman has to go through another professor, Japanese professor, Oshizawa, who translates from the 17th century vernacular Japanese language that Hakuin used into modern Japanese. The language has changed enough in the intervening years that it needs translation. And then Hakuin takes Professor Oshizawa's translations and turns them into English. And they're well worth reading. So here is an excerpt from a book that Hakuin wrote about his life, entitled Goosegrass. I had reached a total impasse, the fears still dominating my thoughts, no idea where to turn for help. Streams of tears ran unconsciously down my cheeks. My gaze happened to go up to the veranda of the guest hall, where hundreds of books had been stacked on top of desks, following the annual airing of the temple library. In Japan, because the weather is so damp, every year they take the scrolls out into the sun on a spring day and unroll them and leave them in the sun to air out and also to get the silverfish and the other bugs out of them that would eat them up. And so it was the end of one of these days that he's talking about. I lit an offering of incense before the books and performed a score or so of prostrations and prayed earnestly to the gods and Buddhas for their help, telling them how 4 or 5 years after shaving my head, I was still at sixes and sevens, had no idea what to do with my life, which of the paths, Buddhism, Confucianism, or Taoism, I should follow. I closed my eyes and I slowly approached a pile of books on one of the desks. With my thumb and forefinger, I reached out and fished blindly among the stacks until I fixed on a single volume. I pulled it out and raised it high above my head in a veneration 2 or 3 times, and then I opened it. He had chosen a work titled Spurring Students Through the Zen Barriers, which has recently come into English translation, not by Hakuin, but by somebody else. This is a Chinese text, a collection of writings by various different masters. He opened the pages randomly to a passage describing the life and practice of the celebrated 10th century Chinese priest Tzu Ming. While engaging in Zazen through the freezing nights of northern China, Tzu Ming had jabbed himself in the thigh with a needle-sharp awl whenever he sensed the sleep demon, quote-unquote, approaching. To Hakuin, Tzu Ming's serendipitous intervention at this juncture could have only one meaning. A person who commits himself to attaining religious awakening must push forward with unwavering determination, whatever difficulties he encounters, until the goal is reached. And this is worth repeating. A person who commits himself or herself to attaining religious awakening must push forward with unwavering determination, whatever difficulties they encounter, until the goal is reached. And so, Hakuin went back to practice. He went back to practice in a very intense way. The Japanese culture tends to encourage that kind of thing. It's amazing to be in a train station, and particularly in a restaurant in a train station, because all the train stations have restaurants, and to watch the Japanese come in, gulp down a bowl of noodles and disappear onto their train. They are always walking swiftly. They don't amble along. And Hakuin was an exemplar of that. He did his practice in a striving way. And we learned some lessons from that as well as he did, because he actually was going so intently in his practice, really, really trying to practice from his head instead of being in his body. And this is a very important distinction. And because of that striving, he actually did end up having a kensho, but he also turned himself into a nervous wreck in the process. And it wasn't until he learned, and it's not clear whether this mountain hermit that he quotes as teaching him how to bring his energy down was the source of it, or whether he just figured it out himself and came up with the story of Hakuyu as a way of expressing it. But at any rate, he had to learn to relax in his practice and focus on his hara, which is why anyone who has trained in any of the Rinzai lineages in Japan, and that includes our Kaplo Roshi, as well as Harada Roshi, emphasizes working from the hara. We want to live from that lowered center of gravity, from our belly, really. It's a very centered way to live. And when we do that and allow the rest of our body to relax, all of our body to relax, really stay out of our heads, then our practice proceeds, deepening naturally. We cannot think our way to awakening. It just doesn't work. People will try, and that is why, particularly one of the koans, the koan Mu, does a dog have the Buddha nature, is fairly effective for people who try to do the practice from their heads, because you can go around in circles with, does a dog have the Buddha nature? Everything has the Buddha nature, but not a dog? What? And finally you reach an impasse and you have to go back into your body, and that's where the answers will come from. And he had to learn that the hard way. But he did practice long and hard, and we are deeply fortunate for that, because at the time he started his practice, Rinzai Zen was in pretty bad shape in Japan. In Japan, in those times, and in earlier times as well, and this happens naturally with religions, they go through periods of being fresh and sharp and right on target, usually early in when they arrive in a given country. And then as people get more and more accustomed to the religion, the interest begins to get a little stagnant, and the religion suffers as a result. And we can see that in America, where so many people who are nominally Christian call themselves Christians, but actually they don't really go to church except perhaps on Christmas and Easter. And Buddhism was going through that kind of situation as well in the time of Hakuin. And the actual depth of practice was largely lacking in Japan of the era. And it was Hakuin who really single-handedly, through the help of his revered teacher, Dokyo Eitan, was able to revitalize Rinzai Zen. Dokyo Eitan, who Hakuin finally encountered after meeting his soul monk student, and being impressed by this guy, the level of understanding of this guy, ended up going to Dokyo Eitan's temple. It was a tiny little, it still is, a tiny little thatched hut cottage in a part of Japan that's not very populated and not very close to anything modern. It takes a while to get there, taking several different trains, including a very local little train, kind of putts along. But Dokyo Eitan was severe in his working with Hakuin, because at the time Hakuin had already had a Kensho experience that he had decided on his own was the deepest Kensho anyone had had in several hundred years. And he was quite puffed up about it. And Dokyo Eitan had to help him realize that it wasn't as big a deal as he thought it was, and that he had a lot farther to go. And with Dokyo Eitan's help, he did go considerably farther. So Hakuin struggled a great deal in his life of practice. He would get discouraged. Then something would reinvigorate him. He did absorb himself quite completely in his practice. In fact, there's a part of what had happened to him. He had been walking, and that was how they did. They would walk from one temple to another all over the country of Japan, because in those days the teaching really consisted of notable priests doing lectures on Buddhist texts. And there would be a lecture meeting that would go several days or 2 or 3 weeks. People would gather for that event, attend the lectures daily, and then when the lectures ended, they would move on to the next such event. And Hakuin was so deeply absorbed in his koan work, well, going from one temple to the next, he actually was carrying his own pack, and he was also carrying the pack of another monk he was traveling with, who was ill at the time. And he and a group of guys were traveling to the next place. And at one point, he was on a ferry boat, and he was so exhausted from all the walking that he immediately fell asleep as soon as he got on the boat. And then some hours later, he woke up, and he was shocked to discover they were still in port. And not only were they still in port, but the rest of the passengers were looking immensely haggard. A number of them had thrown up, and Hakuin said, "How come we're still in port? How come we didn't go?" And the boatman got furious at him, because apparently they had gone and encountered a terrible storm. and had to turn back. And Hagoin had slept through the whole thing. The main take-home from Hagoin's life, and I'll share more of it as we go through Sesshin, is his determination. And you heard in the opening ceremony that one of the three pillars of Zen is great determination, great stubbornness, a willingness to stick with the practice even if we run into all kinds of obstacles. And we will, to a certain degree, if we consider them obstacles, because as the practice goes on, as you also heard in the opening ceremony, we will become more aware of where we are caught, where we are keeping ourselves from being free because of our conditioning, because of our ideas about things, about people, about ourselves, about whether we can do it or not, whether we want to do it or not. It's all kinds of things going on. And then if we've had any level of trauma in our life, that too will come up. And it gives us an incredible opportunity to work with our baggage, really. And the extended out-breath, while tuning into our body, allowing ourselves to be open to possibility, a practice beyond words, this is incredibly effective. And the more you give yourself to this practice, and it will wax and wane. There will be times when you are deeply inspired to practice and to practice deeply. And there are other times when you want to do anything else but. And there will be times when it'll feel like you're in a desert, as far as practice is concerned, or gnawing on a bone that's already been so gnawed on there's nothing left of it. And if you persist even then, and you persist through any frustration, and you persist through any disappointment, you'll go deeper, gradually, gradually, gradually going deeper, and eventually you will be deep enough to be free enough to open to the truth of reality, who you really are. And depending on how deeply you realize that, there will be greater or lesser freedom in your life. There will be some freedom at least. And if you really, really cut the roots of that delusion, then it's very different from then on. And it doesn't matter what circumstances you're in terms of practice. The Three Pillars of Zen includes the true story of a young Japanese woman, Yaeko Iwasaki, whose father started doing Zazen when he was 60 because he suddenly had a fear of death. And so he started doing Zazen, and his daughter saw him doing that. And actually after a year, he had a Kensho experience. Inspired by that, she started doing Zazen. And at the time, she was increasingly ill with tuberculosis and eventually died of it. She was practicing deeply. She was coughing up blood. She was bedridden, feverish, about the opposite of you would think anybody would want to do anything but lie there and hurt. But she lay there and did her practice, increasingly deeply, and for, it's either 2 or 3 weeks in a row, every day she had a deeper and deeper Kensho experience, every single day. and then she died. And Yasutani Roshi was at her bedside when she died, and he said that he had never seen anyone die with such peace. There she was, so ill. All she could do was lie there and cough blood. And she practiced despite that. And she had daily Kensho experiences for at least 2 weeks in a row, every single day, gone deeper, becoming more free, to the point where eventually, when she did die, not long after that, she was totally free to die in peace. It's interesting that people come to Zen practice out of some level of angst, I guess you would call it. I once was talking to Tony Packer about it, and she said she had only met one person in all the time she was teaching, and she also was a psychologist too. And all the time she had was working as a psychologist who had not come to practice through some level of pain. And she said it only took him 6 months to uncover it. But often when we have a Kensho experience, it does enough to relieve the pain that we quit practice. I know that has happened to a number of friends of mine. I hope that doesn't happen to you, because there's so much deeper to go and so much freer to become and so much more joyful to live and so much more to give to others. And with that, I thank you for listening, and we'll stop now and recite the four vows.